Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Phil Dierking, Anna Mateo, and Pete Musto. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, it can be difficult to live in the 21st century without using the internet, a smartphone, or other digital device. A new report shows that electronic banking, internet marketing, and other online activities are no longer just for people in rich countries. The report comes from the International Telecommunication Union, an agency of the United Nations. It notes that hundreds of millions of people in the world's poorest countries are now using the internet and mobile technology. The ITU said that all 47 of the world's least developed countries are making progress in increasing internet access to their citizens. And more than 60% of the people there are able to use a 3G network. The term 3G means the third generation of wireless mobile telecommunication technology. The report said that by the end of 2017, about 700 million people in the least developed countries had signed up for a plan with a mobile phone service provider. In those areas, 80% of the population lives within range of a mobile cellular network. Given this progress, the ITU praised the growth of digital technology. It said the world's least developed countries are on their way to meeting the UN's Sustainable Development Goal on universal and affordable internet access by 2020. Jennifer Ferguson Mitchell is with the ITU. She told VOA that digital connectivity can provide valuable knowledge and information to populations around the world.
It gives farmers access to information on crops, when to plant their crops, weather patterns that are happening. It provides access to online education to communities. It can make micro and small and medium-sized enterprises be able to compete with larger businesses.
The ITU said universal and low-cost internet access can help the poorest countries move forward in fields like education, health, and trade. While the findings sound hopeful, the report identified the lack of digital skills as a barrier to information communication technology and internet use in poor areas. The ITU called on policymakers, industry leaders, and educators to work together to increase digital skills across the least developed countries.
Almost 60 million young people who live in countries affected by conflict or natural disaster are illiterate, the United Nations Children's Fund, or UNICEF, said this week. More investment in education is needed, UNICEF said, to fight the crisis. Nearly 30% of people between the ages of 15 and 19 living in emergency countries cannot read or write. UNICEF has found that illiteracy is a bigger problem among girls and young women. 33% of girls have not learned even the basics of reading. The same is true of 24% of boys living in emergency countries. UNICEF Executive Director Henrietta Fore said the numbers are a clear reminder of the tragic effects that crises can have on a child's education and their future. UNICEF is calling for more financial support for education programs, especially during humanitarian crises. It said only 3.6% of humanitarian money is used for the education of young people living in emergency situations. That makes education one of the least supported areas of humanitarian aid. The agency's yearly Humanitarian Action for Children appeal began on Tuesday. It called for $900 million for countries damaged by man-made and natural disasters. The money would be used on programs such as accelerated learning, teacher training, school rebuilding, and on school supplies. UNICEF also proposed that governments provide young children with early learning opportunities and illiterate young people with specially designed education programs. The findings are based on the UN Educational, Science, and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO, literacy data on 27 emergency countries. The countries with the highest illiteracy rates among people between the ages of 15 and 24 are Niger, 76%, Chad, 69%, South Sudan, 68%, and the Central African Republic, 64%. UNICEF released the new data just before the start of the two-day Global Partnership for Education Replenishment Conference in Dakar, Senegal. The conference is designed to raise money to give all children and youth the opportunity to learn. I'm Phil Dierking.
The world's oceans are sick and getting sicker every day. Two new studies show the warming of Earth's atmosphere is removing oxygen from ocean waters and harming coral reefs. Oxygen is necessary for all life in the oceans, except for a few extremely small organisms. And researchers said oxygen levels are low enough to threaten all the ocean life that depends on it. Denise Breitberg is an ocean scientist at the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center. She is also a member of the Global Ocean Oxygen Network, a team of scientists organized by the United Nations to study the issue. Breitberg told the Associated Press, "If you can't breathe, nothing else matters." That pretty much describes it.
The journal Science published the two studies. The first describes how the growing problem of falling oxygen levels is more complex than experts had thought. The second study shows that rising ocean temperatures are greatly increasing coral reef bleaching events. Scientists with the Global Ocean Oxygen Network reported that more than 32 million square kilometers of ocean are low in oxygen. These affected areas reach a depth of about 200 meters. This area is bigger than Africa, the second largest continent. The scientists say the area of low oxygen levels has grown about 16% since 1950. The Global Ocean Oxygen Network's report is the widest reaching look at decreasing oxygen levels in the world's seas so far. Lisa Levin is a professor at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography and a co-author of the report. In her words, the low oxygen problem is the biggest unknown climate change consequence out there.
Levin said past research had shown low oxygen areas that were the result of agricultural pollution. She said past studies also showed how warmer waters had created a lack of oxygen. But Levin said this latest study shows how both problems are connected by common causes and possible solutions. Co-author Denise Breitberg said that some low oxygen levels in the world's oceans are natural, but not to the extent found. Wind patterns and ocean currents, believed caused by global warming, are preventing oxygen from sinking below the surface of the water. In addition, warmer water does not hold as much oxygen, and less oxygen mixes into the water, she said. In the other study, a team of experts looked at 100 coral reefs around the world. They examined how often the reefs experienced severe bleaching events since 1980. Bleaching happens when water temperatures rise just 1 degree Celsius above the normal high for an area. Before the 1980s, reefs that experienced bleaching would have 25 to 30 years before another event. The new study finds that bleaching events are now only about 6 years apart.
Bleaching is not quite killing the sensitive corals, but it is breaking down the algae that lives inside them. This severely sickens the coral. Co-author Mark Eakin runs the Coral Reef Watch program for the United States National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. He said coral reefs near Guam are some of the hardest hit. He said there have been 8 severe bleaching incidents there since 1994. 4 of the incidents were in the last 5 years. Eakin said that it takes time to recover from bleaching. But, he said, now bleachings are happening too often for coral to recover. Only 6 of the 100 coral reefs had not experienced severe bleaching. 4 are around Australia, 1 is in the Indian Ocean, and another is off South Africa's coast.
But bleaching is not the only issue coral reefs face. Trash is also a danger. Another team of researchers recently reported about tons of plastic waste trapped in coral reefs from Thailand to Australia. The plastic is severely sickening the reefs, they said. That study was also published in the journal Science. It found that a total of 11.1 billion pieces of plastic are stuck in reefs in the Asia-Pacific region. The waste includes plastic bags and fishing equipment. The scientists predicted the amount of plastic would rise 40% by 2025.
Plastic increases the likelihood of coral disease by about 20 times. It can damage the structure, weakening a coral reef's defenses. Plastic can also transport other organisms that harm coral. The study's authors urged stronger restrictions on plastic waste. They also said better management of the fishing industry is necessary to protect coral. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Anna Mateo.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to the Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. During the first half of the 19th century, leaders of the United States could find no answer to the question of slavery. The dispute grew more threatening after the war with Mexico in 1849. Northern states refused to permit slavery in the new territories of California and New Mexico. Southern states declared that they had a constitutional right to bring slaves into the new lands. The South was ready to secede, to leave and break up the Union of States. Then, in 1850, Senator Henry Clay of Kentucky offered a compromise to avoid secession and a likely war between the North and South. He said the Union was permanent and created for all future Americans. He attacked the South's claim that it had the right to leave. He warned the war that would follow Southern secession would be long and bloody. 1 week after Senator Clay spoke, Senator Jefferson Davis of Mississippi explained his position. He did not say much about Clay's proposed compromise. Davis was sure that no good would result from it, not even from stronger laws on the return of escaped slaves. Davis said what was needed was a change in the North's policy toward the South. He said the North must recognize the rights of Southerners, especially the right to take slave property into U.S. territories. Davis said Congress had no right to destroy or limit this right. He admitted that the old Missouri Compromise of 1820 had limited the right to take slaves into the territories. He said the 1820 Compromise worked not because Congress passed it, but because the states agreed to it. Senator Davis said the North was responsible for the growing split in the country because the North was trying to get complete control of the South. He said if these efforts were not stopped, the North someday would be powerful enough to change the Constitution and end slavery everywhere. Davis warned the South would never accept this change. 3 weeks later, the Senate heard another Southern leader, Senator John C. Calhoun of South Carolina. For years, Calhoun was the voice of the South. He now was 68 years old and a sick man. He spent the last week in February writing what he believed to be the true position of the South. Many senators understood it would be his last speech. On Monday, March 4th, the Senate was crowded when Calhoun entered. One by one, friends came to speak to him. The old man's long, gray hair fell to his shoulders. His face was thin and white, but his eyes were bright and his jaw firm. Calhoun was too weak to read his speech. He asked another senator to read it for him. Calhoun said that for a long time he had believed the dispute over slavery, if not settled, would end in disunion. Calhoun said it was clear now to everyone that the Union was breaking apart, that the ties that had held the North and South together were breaking one by one. Three churches, once united across the nation, now were split between the North and South. The major political parties, he declared, were divided in the same way. Calhoun said the North was responsible for all this disunity, because it had destroyed the political balance between the two parts of the country. As the population of the North had grown large, he noted, that part of the country seized political and economic control. The North passed tariff bills the South opposed. It had filled most of the offices in the federal government. It closed the new territories to Southern slaveholders. And, said Calhoun, it viciously attacked the Southern institution of slavery. The situation was so bad, he said, that the South could not, with honor and safety, remain in the Union. How can the Union be saved, he asked. Not by the compromise proposed by the senator from Kentucky. There is but one way, a full and final settlement with justice of all the questions disputed by the two sections. The South asks for justice, simple justice, unless she ought not to take. She has no compromise to offer but the Constitution, and no concession or surrender to make. She has already surrendered so much that she has little left to surrender. At the end of Calhoun's speech to the Senate, Southern lawmakers crowded around the old man, congratulating him. But many of them could not agree with his demands and the violence of his words. By now, most Southerners believed that Senator Clay's proposals were a reasonable way to settle the difference and protect the Union. Yet Clay worried that Northerners might reject his proposals. Many in the North felt slavery was wrong. They opposed Clay's compromise because it might permit slavery in New Mexico, and because it called for stronger laws on the return of slaves who had escaped to the North. So Clay asked an important senator from the North to speak in support of his proposals. Daniel Webster represented the northeastern state of Massachusetts. Senator Webster believed that slavery was evil. Yet he believed that national unity was more important. He did not want the nation to divide. He did not want to see the end of the United States of America. Webster was 68 years old, as old as Calhoun. 3 days after Calhoun's speech, Webster spoke to the Senate. His voice was weaker now, but his words rang with the same strength as years earlier. I speak today, he said, to save the Union. I speak today out of a concerned and troubled heart. I speak for the return of a spirit of unity. I speak for the return of that general feeling of agreement which makes the blessings of this Union so special to us all. Senator Webster spoke of how he hated slavery. He spoke of his fight against the spread of slavery, but he disagreed with those who wanted laws making slavery illegal in new territories. It would not be wise to pass such laws, he said. They would only make the South angry. They would only push the South away from the Union. Then Webster spoke about the things the North and South had done to make each other angry. One, he said, was the failure of the North to return runaway slaves. He said the South had good reason to protest. It was a matter of law. The law was contained in Article 4 of the nation's Constitution. Every member of every Northern legislature, Webster said, has sworn to support the Constitution of the United States. And the Constitution says that states must return runaway slaves to their owners. This part of the Constitution has as much power as any other part. It must be obeyed. Next, Webster spoke about abolition societies. These were organizations that demanded an end to slavery everywhere in the country. I do not think that abolition societies are useful, Webster said. At the same time, I believe that thousands of their members are honest and good citizens who feel they must do something for liberty. However, their interference with the South has produced trouble. As an example, Webster spoke about the state of Virginia. Slavery was legal there. Webster noted that public opinion in Virginia had been turning against slavery until abolitionists angered the people. After that, he said, no one would talk openly against slavery. He said abolitionists were not ending slavery, but helping it continue. Then Webster said the North also had a right to protest about some things the South had done. He said the South was wrong to take slaves into new American territories. He said attempts to expand slavery violated earlier agreements to limit slavery to areas where it already existed. Webster said the North also had a right to protest statements by Southern leaders about working conditions in the North. Southerners often said that slaves in the South lived better lives than free workers in the North. Webster appealed to both sides to forgive each other. He urged them to come to an agreement. He said the South could never leave the Union without violence. Webster said the two sides were joined together socially, economically, culturally, and in many other ways. There was no way to divide them. No Congress, he said, could establish a border between the North and South that either side would accept. In general, Webster's speech to the Senate was moderate. He wanted to appeal to reason, not emotion. Yet it was difficult for him to be unemotional. His voice rose as he finished. Secession, he called out. Peaceable secession. Your eyes and mine will never see that happen. There can be no such thing as peaceable secession. We live under a great constitution. Is it to be melted away by secession, as the snows of a mountain are melted away under the sun? Let us not speak of the possibility of secession. Let us not debate an idea so full of horror. Let us not live with the thought of such darkness. Instead, let us come out into the light of day. Let us enjoy the fresh air of liberty and union. Northern abolitionists quickly criticized Daniel Webster's speech. They called him a traitor. But most people of the North accepted Webster's appeal for compromise. His speech cooled the debate that threatened a complete break between the North and South. Yet the speech was not the end of the debate. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History, from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.